Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can. Because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Hi, I'm Larry Rifkin. Guns, 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 and a history of violence that defines the American culture in many ways. There have been many books written about this. There's a new book by my own senator here in Connecticut, Christopher Murphy, about it. But I turn back to Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz and her book, Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. Now, many of us may think that the Second Amendment really was put into place so that you and I can protect our homes against an invader, or that we were worried about the power that might accrue to the central federal government that we were building. But she argues in her book that U.S. history is quintessentially gun history. And gun history is a history of racial terror and genocide. And when you go back to the wars against Native Americans, when you look at slave patrols, her argument is that we really need to understand all of that to understand even what is going on in the streets of America today. So, without any further warm-up or lead-in, let me go to Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz and her book, Loaded. I know you're going to learn an awful lot today about America's gun culture on America Trends.
With me on America Trends is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and she's written a book called Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. And it really is eye-opening, so you need to stay for this entire podcast. And Roxanne, before we really delve into the contents of your book, let me just read the Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. There have been so many interpretations of the Second Amendment. Does it deal with an individual right, a collective right? I mean, break it down for us.
Well, you know, what's left out of every commentary that's ever been made, except for a couple of Supreme Court justices alluding to it, is the history. You know, what was going on? What was the situation? And the situation was that the 13 colonies over a period of 200 years, almost 200 years, had been established through a program of settler violence, of colonial settler violence, of taking Native people's land, and Native people were farmers with hounds, burning their towns, burning their crops. And then the colonial government and the, you know, the British Empire profited and benefited from the plantation systems that were established in the North. It was more like apple orchards to make, everything was about, you know, making alcoholic beverages at the time, too, the sugar in the Caribbean to make rum. But these were the commodities that were then circulated worldwide, and of course, fibers, non-food crops, cotton, indigo, rice, but rice was grown in South Carolina, plantation rice worked by slaves to feed the British enslaved people of the Caribbean, not to you know, for it. There was no self-sufficient farming going on. It was all commercial. It was agribusiness, and that required land. So this is the British settler colonialism, the first experiment in the already 200 years of European colonialism, the first experiment in settler colonialism, where you use the indigenous peoples of labor, like in Mexico and Peru. You displace or kill those people in one way or another, eradicate them. Expurgate was the term they used in colonial Virginia and Massachusetts, to simply destroy them and take their land. Well, the native people resisted fiercely and armed resistance, so that at any time they were pushing to take more land, there were native people at first displaced and then reorganizing themselves, often in federations, to try to take back that land or at least limit further expansion. And this occurred over 200 years until they reached the Appalachian Allegheny chain of mountains. And almost all of the indigenous people east of that chain had either been, some had been Christianized and, you know, kind of put on colonial reservations, but the majority of them had taken refuge there or up with the Haudenosaunee in northern New York and Canada, the fierce Mohawks who fought fiercely. So they were all, you know, rearranged, but they were pretty much free on the other side. That was, that, in fact, the British called it Indian country. And they established a proclamation line in 1763 to not, that the British settlers, the Anglo settlers in the 13 colonies, could not expand any farther into Indian country. And they did that not because they were great beneficiaries of the native people, but because they knew that the natives were very, very well organized and that it would be very costly to have wars. And they were, the colonies were already very productive. So it was the settlers' initiative that they wanted the land. It had become a, because what happened is that people who were landless, who came to the colonies and they were going to stake their claims, Andrew Jackson's a good example, poverty-stricken Scottish, Scots-Irish kid, whose parents died, and, you know, who, their goal was to own land and to get slaves, but rarely could they, on any massive scale, numerically, come to compete with the already established planters. So the planters would then seize the land. They couldn't compete. And then they would, these settlers, most of them Scots-Irish, which my father's family comes from. I even know the story from oral history in my family, that they were hand-to-hand fighting the Indians, you know, and taking. So this was so effective when, you know, and it's the main reason that the planters, you know, Virginia wanted independence, because they needed that as an escape valve for, you know, this growing poor class of poor white people.
Okay, well, we know that, you know, they had this one crop and they were starting to wear out the land, this whole westward expansion that you talk about so vividly in your book, Looted. And you tell us, you know, that some of the fables that we tell ourselves about a worrisome notion about the federal government that we were building as part of the new Constitution, that that wasn't the reason that we wanted a Second Amendment. It really was an individual right, not a collective right, and that it really dealt with the indigenous peoples and ultimately to those who were slaves. But you also say at the outset that we, when we look at it, what the Founding Fathers intended by the Second Amendment will unsettle liberal gun control advocates and the open carry aficionados alike. Why is that?
Well, because they don't either don't know or it's willful ignorance, because it's no secret what was going on at the time and why the United States was even formed in the first place was to expand to the Pacific Ocean. These were imperialists, these Anglo, the British Empire was an empire. So the individuals within it were imperialists, just like the population of the United States today is imperialist. There's a pride that comes in that. So the United States was formed as an imperialist and settler colonial entity. They needed these settlers. They feared them in some ways. But they, because they were rapidly trying to get land, but they also needed that escape valve of those people being able to get land. And that wasn't really realized until the Andrew Jackson regime. And then, of course, the ethnic cleansing of all the indigenous people east of the Mississippi.
Right. But let me go back to 1791, just to be clear about the thesis in the book, which I think is really, again, for many, going to be a revelation, that it's not about hunting, it's not about worrisome federal meddling in our affairs necessarily. It really was about allowing people, individuals, not just the collective militia, really to have the ability to add land to their property holdings and to go and expand beyond the borders that we had at the time that the Constitution was framed.
Yeah, and the other thing that gets, the gun control advocates get wrong is that thinking the militias mean the state militias, because there were colonial militias in every colony as they formed. George Washington was the general of the colonial militia of Virginia, for instance. These were sanctioned collective state militias of, colonial states that were put in Article 8 of the Constitution, that they would exist as state militias. And that means that they, exactly like the National Guard today, later that was changed, to simply call it the National Guard. But they could be called upon by the federal government, but the governors had to, give permission. So that structure has nothing to do with the Second Amendment, just because the same word is used. And militia just means carrying arms, So people think that means the National Guard. And it's ridiculous, because the National Guard was in Article 8 of the Constitution. Why would they put it in individual Bill of Rights? Duplicate it. It's absolutely absurd idea. But if people don't want to know about the settler militias, the self-organized settler militias, and that well regulated is in that Second Amendment. They were self-regulated. Here, people in the United States take great pride in how self-motivating they are, self-reliant they are as people. And yet when they look back and say, well regulated, they say, well, that has to mean the state regulates them, which is ridiculous.
Okay. Now, can I want to keep moving forward to where we are today, of course. But when we go back, we have to remember the slave patrols as well, because that's an important part of the story, too. But as briefly as you can.
Yeah. Slave patrols were brought by settlers from Barbados who moved to create the colony of South Carolina. Because at first there was only New England, and New England even included Virginia. Virginia to Massachusetts, where it was New England. And then Virginia got established as a unique colony. And out of that, but it was huge, everything that's West Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, everything in Georgia, it was all Virginia, Commonwealth of Virginia. So it got broken down by the British authorities. They allowed these planters from Barbados to come. Now, Barbados in the Caribbean, where the white people were like 1% of the population and everyone else was enslaved, they were very brutal. They developed industrialized agriculture, and they brought it to South Carolina. And with that, they brought the slave patrols that they had developed. The slave patrols were people that they brought, you know, the kind, they would import, you know, poor white people into the Barbados colony. So they brought some of these, they brought the slave patrols with them. But once they started trying to organize, you know, in the South Carolina colony, first of all, that there was still tremendous indigenous resistance, and also slave marooning together in the Great Dismal Swamp of South Carolina. So there was already these individualized militias acting, but the authorities then, you know, started taking these militias that were fighting for their own land and killing the Indians, and tried to carve out of them their, you know, slave patrols. And they rebelled against it. They didn't want, you know, they wanted land. They didn't want to, you know, work for the planters and, you know, do their dirty work. So it was very, very difficult to, they had to pay them. You know, they had to pay them. So this spread, it was so effective, the slave patrols, in controlling the enslaved population, that it then spread to the Virginia colony, to Maryland and New York and everywhere. So this is the, I always say that these slave patrols existed, you know, and grew in expertise and using horses and whips and all kinds of psychological methods and rewards for the slave patrollers, in that they could say they caught a runaway, and they could keep the, if that runaway had weapons or had a horse or anything, they could keep that as booty themselves if they, you know, so there were a lot of rewards for them. And unfortunately, with the Irish famine, the millions of starving Irish who came had to take the lowliest jobs, you know, and so basically many, many, you know, building the Erie Canal and all. But many, many were recruited to be in slave patrols. So that's a very...
Okay, well, that's... Okay, that gives us a sense. But I want to...
Let me finish just this one point. That these slave patrols existed up to the Civil War and during the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And after the Civil War, when it was illegal, you know, when there was Reconstruction, they put hoods on and called themselves the Ku Klux Klan. And when Reconstruction was abandoned, they took off their hoods and they were the sheriffs and the police. So this is the genealogy of the U.S. police forces, and why
right.
Still any black man walking down the street gets shot, because it might be, you know, it's in their DNA.
So in a sense, because we don't truly understand why the Second Amendment is now so important to so many people in this country today, we don't understand its beginnings. We don't understand perhaps why it is that it remains such a very important part of the American culture, though we have many of the societal ills and economic and social inequalities that built up during a period when the gun was used to enforce those inequities. So why today still is the gun culture, and I'm reading some former Republican saying that gun worship has gotten worse in the recent period. How do we explain that?
Well, I thought a lot about that. I think it's, you know, I've done a statistical study as well as can be done, since, you know, there's no real counting of guns, but there's more or less one gun per person in the United States population. So now there's 380 million people, so they figure there are at least 380 million
But you tell us in the book that it used to be that 50% of families or households had guns. Now we're down to a third, but that third has many more guns per household.
Yeah, so there's one gun per person, but in fact only 30% of the population own guns. And so that averages 8 weapons each. That the profile of who those people are comes down to something like 60% white men, who are only about 30% of the population. So I think, you know, we can, there's a definite correlation between the tip of the spear that you see literally of the armed white protesters, you know, in Michigan and Sacramento and all over the place against the restrictions for the virus, that we've seen a lot, you know, in the last 10 years, mm-hmm. in particular since Obama was elected, and the whole that whole racial panic that happened, you know, with because that is their nightmare, you know, deeply, deeply racist. It's mixed with anti-Semitism, which their narrative is that Jews have a desire to rule the world. So in the United States, they are behind the civil rights movement. They are using African Americans who are only apes, you know, and don't have the intelligence themselves to try to take power, using them as a front. And so it's a very sick and dangerous, you know, narrative that they, and it has all kinds of other, you know, aspects to it.
But let me go back to, in the book, you say that until the mid-20th century, not a lot of people were thinking about the Second Amendment. I mean, we talk and we venerate the First Amendment. It is so important to all of us. But the Second Amendment was never something that was much discussed. And so I'm curious as to why, and I'm curious as to why you pin the mid-20th century as one of those turning points. Is it because of the civil rights movement?
Second Amendment was just taken for granted. No one ever challenged it. And other than not very lethal hunting guns in rural areas, did African-Americans really have weapons? They're very expensive and poor people didn't have them. Military people might keep a few weapons. But with the civil rights movement, this was sort of, you know, like Obama getting elected, only 10,000 times more panic. The Brown versus Board of Education decision to desegregate schools in 1953 brought immediately the White Citizens Council's revival of the Ku Klux Klan, the John Birch Society, which was a rich people's, you know, like the Koch brothers' father was a founding member of the John Birch Society. So they actually created the fear of communism. I became aware of that when in Oklahoma, as a teenager, I had become in the mid-1950s, I had become extremely anti-racist and pro-civil rights. And so I started receiving how they got people's addresses to make sure you know that they have some collusion with the federal government. I started getting all these materials from the White Citizens Council. And they puzzled me because they had pictures, the Metropolitan Opera, which I loved, was broadcast every Saturday in rural Oklahoma. They had pictures of, they said the Metropolitan Opera was communist. Now, I didn't think communism was a good thing at all, you know, but it was something I liked, and I said, how could it be communist? And they had pictures of black and white opera stars side by side, you know, and sometimes in art, you know, depending on the opera, sometimes embracing. And that was it, you know, communism and white supremacy were completely entwined. And I think actually the white supremacy latched on to the Cold War anti-Russian, you know, almost like a racist anti-Russian, but a Red Scare. So that they definitely, the refounding of the Klan, but then all kinds of other groups started. And then with the Vietnam War, with the vets coming back, many of them, you know, very strong white racists, a lot of them from the South, they started arming themselves and were about 75%, considered to be about maybe 75% of the membership of the white nationalist.
Our ex-military.
Ex-military.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes us different. Our partners are true business advisors, listening, analyzing, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, anticipating your future goals and drafting plans to make sure you get there. Because at Bloom Shapiro, achieving your success and satisfaction is how we measure ours. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Let me just remind the audience that we're talking to Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. The book is called Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment, and it really does offer some insights that very few of us really gleaned in our history books. And I've got to say that you start off the book by indicating, so I just want people to understand, that you know something about guns, and you actually have fired firearms. So, I mean, this is not someone who hates guns per se, but you kind of swore that off after a couple of years of kind of fascination with it. But you tell us that as a society, we just haven't weaned ourselves off this fascination. We built an incredible industry around the gun manufacturing. And of course, you try to also put in perspective the NRA. A lot of people look at them as the forward edge of all of this, but in many ways, they're really a supporting character in all of this.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest mistake of the gun control advocates is having, you know, a single enemy, the NRA. And it's actually counterproductive because they're not understanding how the NRA works, that it has a popular base. It has a constituency that is devoted to guns. And so it's basically a clearinghouse. You know, they monitor Congress, but locally NRA members, most of it's done on the local level, monitor state legislatures, dog catchers, everyone that comes up for election. What is your stance on guns? And then they either get that person elected or get them not elected. And that's how they have come to control almost all the governorships, all of the, you know, legislatures, and except for, you know, the two coasts. So the NRA was politicized in the 1970s when the first time any organization was ever established that had Second Amendment in the title of it, I'm almost sure, I can't find any other, was founded in 1973. It's called the Second Amendment Foundation. Mm-hmm. And they then, and I think they established themselves precisely to colonize, you know, take over this rather, you know, sportsman's organization, the NRA. Because the NRA already had nonprofit status. It had membership. And so they did. They infiltrated their members and were able to overthrow the existing, you know, executive and board and all in 1977. That's when, and during, it was really nourished during the Reagan era. Ronald Reagan loved the NRA. He spoke at their conventions. So they they grew exponentially and really became the, even though they still had a front of sportsmen, you know, and just people who just were fascinated with guns, gun collectors, and, you know, fairly benign people who, you know, never even went out to a shooting gallery or anything, but just just had guns, and they also dealt with hunting and fishing and, you know, stuff like that, sportsman kind of stuff. So that, you know, is really how the NRA became a white nationalist organization, which it is. And I often get, you know, challenged on that in interviews or, you know, just talking to people that, well, not everyone, there are 5 million members, you know, and they're not everyone. I said, no, they aren't, but they should leave because they're in a white nationalist organization. So I found out that, you know, the this club I belong to, like, say, I am in AAA. You know, I don't vote. I don't care.
And a lot of people do leave country clubs for restrictions. So, again, they should study up on the history. And I think that's what your message is, that really we should go back into our history to understand the role that the gun has played, a very integral role in the development of our society. But some of us do ponder, well, why is it seemingly taking on even more importance during the many cultural divides that we see in our country today? But I want to ask you a couple more questions about where we are today, because we spent an awful lot of time, appropriately, of course. I'm from Connecticut, so Sandy Hook, recently part of our terrible history here. And we talk about these mass shootings. You remind us that we're talking about 2% of the fatalities with guns are from these mass shootings. And you also tell us that as much as we argue about semi-automatic and automatic and such, that we're really talking about the handgun as still being the most often used weapon in our society against one another.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, you know, in Connecticut, as you well know, is the heartland of
of manufacturing,
of gun production, of, you know, an export. You know, it was the very first corporation of the United, well, even before it was the United States, the Continental Congress, Alexander Hamilton, incorporated the Hartford Arms in Connecticut. It was the very first U.S. corporation.
Well, you talk also about the Winchester Arms. There's Colt, of course. Yes, that's a big part of our history, clearly.
I think that there's, you know, there is this lack of understanding of the history, and leaving Native people out of the center of what how the United States came to be. I mean, by many means, by saying, oh, they were only sparsely populated, they'd all been killed by disease, they weren't there. But you figure that 300 years, well, from 1607 to 1890, that it took to take the continent, their only barrier was, you know, they got rid, the Spanish were gone, the French were gone, the Russians were gone. Their only barrier from just taking it all immediately was indigenous resistance.
And you remind us, of course, that we're talking about guerrilla-like asymmetrical war during that period. We talk about it today. And you also, by the way, do tie our global expansionism into our history. So I really encourage people to read the book. But getting back to this issue of mass shootings and handguns versus semi-automatic, the debates that we have today, I mean, are they superfluous? Or, I mean, what should we be talking about as it relates to America's founding, its history, and where we are today in relation to the gun?
I wrote a previous book on Indigenous People's History of the United States, and in 2014. And that book is also in a young people's version now and in the schools. It's had an incredible reception. And I have, in the last 6 years, spoken to tens of thousands of people. And I find such an incredible reception because it's almost like people, once they have that information, just that basic information about the United States, it just clarifies things for them. There's a kind of block to it that is so pervasive in the society, you know, with the repetition of the master narrative in its many different forms, you know, kind of multiculturalism, but everything gets sucked into the black hole of that narrative. I actually feel somewhat optimistic, but I also feel an awful lot, I have to say, of the people who responded so enthusiastically are young people of color. But that's great. They're, you know, the next generation that's going to do something, who have more information. Also, makes them understand their own situation better. You know, if they're African American, if they're immigrant Mexican or Asian, how immigrants have been. That's my new book. You know, it's not a nation of immigrants either. It's repressive to outsiders. So I am optimistic in that sense, but that people can change. But I am very concerned about the growing white nationalism that seems to, you know, really really monitored the last 4 years since I've, you know, worked on that book and published mm-hmm. it and then talked about it. That coincides. I wrote that, the first draft, in the summer of 2016, when Trump was doing stadium things and watching that. So I have monitored the growth of the white nationalist arm, you know, and the presence, the public presence, that they consider him, you know, their leader. And he's in power, you know, and the Senate is controlled by these people. And the Congress is, you know, just barely.
Well, we are recording this in 2020, and we don't know, you know, the outcome of the election. But overriding all of this, the Supreme Court of the United States and its role in protecting what is considered and is a constitutional protected activity, owning a gun. Do you see the Supreme Court getting active? Recently, they sidestepped a major decision on gun rights coming out of New York City. Of course, the Heller decision in 2008, I believe it was, stands to recognize, and getting back to handguns versus semi-automatic, that the government does have the ability to regulate arms. Where are we legally, given the importance of gun rights constitutionally and to so many people as part of the culture?
Well, you know, it has to be legislation. I think the gun control advocates make a big mistake by focusing on the federal so much, because like everything else, you know, this is a federalistic country where governors, you know, and more with the right wing, the governors are in control, and the state legislatures and even counties, even municipalities. You know, the Heller decision was based on a Washington, D.C. case. So who was working on, you know, someone was doing good work there in Washington, D.C., you know, getting a gun control, but then it gets knocked down. Because, in fact, and as long as that Second Amendment is in the Constitution and not revealed as inherently racist and white supremacist and taken out, that is the only country in the world that has it, you know. That's why they can do gun control in other countries. And after there's a mass shooting like New Zealand, like 3 days later, you know, there's banned a bunch of weapons, you know, and but that can't be done here, whether on the local level or anywhere else. And they won't admit that. They keep saying it doesn't mean what it says. And it does mean what it says. So it takes confronting that. Well, why was that done then in the Constitution, that it was to kill Indians and control African Americans? They, you know, the majority of this country is still white, and they don't want to admit that. They want to admit to all kinds of crimes and misdemeanors, but not to the origin itself.
But let me ask you today, here we are in contemporary America 2020, and we do have a sea to shining sea. We go from the Atlantic to Pacific. Slavery, thank goodness, was abolished a long time back, and we've been trying to remedy some of those inequities, but we're still struggling. We know that. But why then is the gun, in a very settled, industrialized, very cosmopolitan nation generally, I mean, why is it so much still such a sacred cow, if you will?
Well, for one thing, it's, you know, to get into a little Freudian psychology, it really is a fetish. It's a fetish, and, you know, how fetishes work, you invest an inanimate object with power. you invest it, you give your power to that object, and it then tells you what to do. The Chekhov play was very insightful. You put a gun in on the table in the first scene. By the third act, it has to go off, you know, because it brings attention to itself. You know, it is, it's a powerful, and people feel empowered. I hear women saying, oh, I feel so empowered. I went out and learned to shoot a AK-47. It was so thrilling. But, you know, so is cocaine, but it's not a good habit. You know? It's like, so that, I think, if people understand that they're mentally, you know, have a mental problem, not just mass shooters having a mental problem, but they have a mental problem, you know, for respecting. And it's not just the gun owners, because 70% of the people in this country, when they are polled over and over, say they totally respect the Second Amendment and think that people have the right to bear arms. There just need to be some regulation. And so that's, you know, that's the trap. And that's why I did the book. And it's something that people, you know, really, really don't want to. I always have some gun rights people. Often they are in audiences when I speak, and I had one in February in L.A. that was organized by a coalition of gun rights, gun control advocates in L.A., and they are wonderful, dedicated people, and almost all of them start up with someone in a family, a survivor, either someone who's been shot and survived themselves or families. And so it's heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking. The stories are heartbreaking. And yet every one of them will say that they almost always call it not gun control, but gun safety, which, mm-hmm. you know, implies that it's okay to have as many guns as you want, but just, you know, have a place to lock them up and stuff. And you know, really not getting into any anything that would discredit. One person in the audience in that one in L.A., a very young guy, asked why we, after I spoke, there was a small panel with a brother of a post office worker who was killed like 25 years ago, and a constitutional lawyer, and myself then fielding questions, you know, and talking to each other. He asked, and then there was the moderator who was very much a gun control advocate, activist himself. And he asked, why do you have people who are just for gun control there? Why didn't you have someone from, you know, gun advocate, someone from the NRA or someone? And the moderator immediately said, well, we apologize for that. We did invite someone, but they had to cancel at the last minute, which often happens when I speak. They don't come, you know, they don't say mm-hmm. anything. Because I think they know what it's really about. I think they actually know what the guns are about. So I spoke up and I said, well, I disagree. I don't think it's beneficial at all to have them get up and make their propaganda about guns, because, you know, they have no credibility. And there was this kind of booing or hiss in the audience.
Interesting. Let me ask you in closing, Roxanne, in closing, the United States, you write, is not unique among nations in forging origin myths. But if those myths don't really want to talk about the indigenous peoples of the United States in terms of 300 years of, lots of activity to eradicate them and to be able to settle all the way from the Atlantic to the Pacific, I mean, how do we get past that? I mean, the gun is a big part of that. And it's now enshrined in the Constitution. I mean, if we don't really want to understand that, how do we even get past some of the inequities that exist in modern day America and even have an honest discussion about guns if we don't really want to go back to the beginning?
Well, you know, now we have this intractable partisanship in the United States, with, I'm sure, probably 60% of the people not, you know, not thinking about any of these things at all. But this is the, you know, the who holds the power? I mean, to have a man elected who made a big deal about, you know, going to the NRA convention when he was campaigning, to campaign on that basis and get elected, and showing us, I mean, what it should show us, and we should look into it with open eyes and courage and say, he has a base. The NRA has a base, and they are white nationalists, armed white nationalists, and very wealthy people who want to do away with government entirely, like the Koch brothers, like the, I can't even remember all those families' names, but they're all in the White House now. And they want to disassemble. They say they want to reduce the government to the size you can drown it in the bathtub. So you have that combination. I'm sure they hold their nose that they don't like these armed right-wing racist people. Probably they don't. But they're, you know, that's their army. And a lot of them are in the regular army, by the way, too. So it's, I think we just aren't willing to really, really admit where we are. And unless we know where we are and what the pieces are, there's no way we can figure out how to get out of it, you know, or how to
change it. And it seems like neither side is in the business of being able to convince the others. And it's really a fascinating topic, and one that you unpack in a way that I've never read before, to give us the clarity that we need to at least go back to the framing of this issue if we want to have an honest conversation about it. Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. And I really recommend people read it, because even some of the great characters that have come out of lore and Western lore, whether it be Daniel Boone or many others, are talked about in this book. You also, in the book, reference so many other important publications about guns for somebody who's really interested in delving into this topic. So your book is remarkable, and I want to thank you for being part of America Trends today.
Well, thank you, Tim. It was wonderful, and thank you for your kind words about the book. And it is City Lights. We should mention City Lights Books in San Francisco is a great book company and store to support.
Okay. Thank you so much, Roxanne.
America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.